Blog Talk Radio.
Hello everyone, this is Peter Paul Verzola with The New Shadow. This is November 19th, an interesting day, a lot of interesting birthdays on this day in November. Three media people, interesting. Ted Turner of CNN, or as some people call it, the Communist News Network. Dick Cavett, the acerbic radio talk show host. And Larry King, CNN. Also, for you underwear fans, Calvin Klein's birthday today. Other birthdays are President James Garfield, one of our assassinated presidents. We hope that never happens again, but it did. Tommy Dorsey, the famous World War II jazz band, dance band musician. And, of course, who Frank Sinatra learned a lot about on phrasing and his voice. In fact, coming up, one of our shows we'll have what a Russian diplomat and Frank Sinatra had in common. Very interesting. And then, of course, Indira Gandhi, the daughter of Nehru, who was a political associate and a supporter of Mahatma Gandhi. Indira Gandhi Prime Minister of India, who was assassinated by a Sikh guard, which goes to show that women also can run the risk of being assassinated. And we had the Empress of Austria, Empress Elizabeth, she was assassinated. And then, of course, I think there were a couple others. There was a official of the state of Nevada. I think it was about 10 years ago. She was murdered or assassinated since she was a public official. But women don't have immunity. That's one of the political fictions. And then, of course, then we have Cab Calloway, great black musician who was featured in with Dan Aykroyd and I'm getting slow in my old age. Famous movie about Chicago police and black musicians. And then a figure of derision, Stepan Feshet, who was a black tap dancer, a dancer during the, I think, 20s and 30s. And because he seemed to suck up to, quote, white people, he was criticized. And, I think we've gone beyond that, I hope. And then one of the patron saints of immigrants, Emeril Lazarus, she died today, excuse me. These people died today on November 19th. And she was famous for that phrase, "Give me your tired and your poor." And historical dates, in 1493, Columbus landed in what is now Puerto Rico. And, of course, Leonard Bernstein's famous song in West Side Story about Puerto Rico. And then in 1919, we'll get into this with Trevor Hodges, the Senate rejected the Treaty of Versailles. Just shows you a president who thinks he can negotiate treaties without the advice and consent of the Senate. So they slapped Woodrow Wilson down, and that contributed to his death. We had also in 1959, we had Ford Motor Company was way ahead of its time with the Edsel. The Edsel was named after one of Henry Ford's sons, and Edsel was always in the shadow of the dictatorial Henry Ford I, who was pro-Nazi and a racist, and they had some horrible labor practices at the Ford Motor Company, and they had a thug called Harry Bennett, who used to beat up and they may have killed auto worker protesters, and this gave the rise, the impetus to the United Auto Workers, started by Walter Reuther, who was kind of red. He went to Russia to work in the auto plants there. And it's interesting that Henry Ford, I think Stalin asked General Motors and Ford to set up an auto plant in Russia. And it was, and they stole the reason that the T-34, one of the best tanks ever produced, because it was light, very effective, didn't have the armor that the Germans Panzer tanks had, but they used the tractor system of Henry. They stole it from Henry Ford's tractors. So it just goes to show you that, that's another thing that the Russians stole and got away with. In 1970, IBM came out with the first digital computer, but it didn't. The marketing was either ahead of its time or didn't work out. And then in 1985, it was the first meeting between President Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev. And then also in that year, for all these students of law and civil judgments, the largest civil judgment in the history of the federal court system, $10.53 billion, was awarded Penzance in their lawsuit, their contract lawsuit, by Texaco. And then in 1998, we had the U.S. House of Representatives Judiciary Committee started impeachment hearings against Bill Clinton. Now, in 1863, I want to get back to this because it ties into political fiction. Abraham Lincoln gave his Gettysburg Address. It was also a speaker there, and it's one of the shortest but most effective presidential speeches and speeches in the whole history of speechmaking and public oratory. The other speaker was a guy named Edward Everett Hale. He gave one of the longest speeches at Gettysburg, and nobody remembers what he said. But what's important, one of the myths about the Emancipation Proclamation was that it freed the slaves. It did no such thing. Here, I'm going to read from what it did, what Lincoln wrote to Horace Greeley, who was a famous newsman of the time, one of the media people. As to the policy I seem to be pursuing, as you say, I have meant to leave no one in doubt. I would save the Union. I would save it in the shortest way under the Constitution. The sooner the national authority can be restored, the nearer the Union will be the Union as it was. If there would be those who would not save the Union unless they would do it at the same time save slavery, I do not agree with them. If there be those who would not save the Union unless they could at the same time destroy slavery, I do not agree with them. My paramount objective in this struggle is to save the Union. It is not to either to save or destroy slavery. If I could save the Union without freeing any slave, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing all the slaves, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing some of the slaves and leaving others alone, I would also do that. What I would do about slavery and the colored race, I do because I believe it would help to save the Union. And what I forbear because I do not believe it would help to save the Union. I shall do less whenever I shall believe that what I am doing hurts the cause, and I shall do more whatever I believe that will doing more will help the cause. Now, this is interesting, and it comes up, and it's an issue that blacks and other ethnic groups who are demanding reparations. This is not talked about. Here's what Lincoln said. The forgotten portions, or this is just a preview. The forgotten portions include further declarations of executive policy. Lincoln promised that the executive would, in due time, recommend that all citizens of the United States who have remained loyal thereto shall be compensated for all losses by acts of the United States, including the loss of slaves. He announced that he would again urge upon Congress the adoption of a practical measure tendering pecuniary aid to all the loyal slave states that would voluntarily adopt immediate or gradual abolition of slavery within their limits. He would continue to advise the colonization of free Africans abroad. Remember, he's the political godfather of Liberia. There is still to be mentioned a detail of the proclamation with, except for its historical setting in the general perspective of Lincoln's political strategy, would appear inexplicable. One might expect in the opening statement whether the author of the proclamation boldly assumes dictatorial power as immediate linking of that assumption with the matter in hand, but that does not happen. So Lincoln begins the Emancipation Proclamation, which very people have read today. I, Abraham Lincoln, President of the United States of America and Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy thereto, do hereby proclaim and declare that hereafter, as heretofore, the war will be prosecuted for the objection of practically restoring the constitutional relations, between the United States and each of the states and the people thereof, in which states that relation is or may be suspended or disrupted. So, again, The whole objective of Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation was, you could look at it this way, to hold out, I won't say a bale of cotton, but a carrot or a bunch of carrots to say, if you come back in the Union, we'll work out a way in concert with Congress to compensate you for your pecuniary losses. This is to the slave owners. So that it wasn't, emancipation wasn't about freeing slaves. That is a political fiction. And so that's what something people should pay attention to, and it should really get into this in history, because it's one of these political myths that keep that the longer it goes on, the harder it is to dispel it and to correct it. But it's fascinating. Interestingly, Seward, the guy who purchased Alaska, and as a digression, we recently had, and you can download on from the New Shadow Amicus Veritas Blog Talk Archives, Richard Badisco's interview. He's a retired San Francisco policeman, but his family, the Russian side, was involved in the purchase of Alaska, which was one of our two of our best purchases, that in the Louisiana Territory. But it's fascinating that Seward tried to block the issuance of that proclamation, and also some of the things that Lincoln did. I hate, this is a cynical way to put it, but I think in a cynical way, had Lincoln lived, he would have surely been impeached. And poor Johnson, who succeeded him and tried to wind up bind the wounds of the Civil War and restore order and justice, and to try to help the freed, quote, Negro, that's the term was used at the time. They heaped all their scorn and did everything they could to undercut him. And so Andrew Johnson, the poor tailor, who himself was an indentured servant, a lot of people don't know that about Andrew Johnson. There is a famous film with Van Heflin, and we have a library copy about Andrew Johnson. And he kept Missouri and Kentucky in the war. He was a Union general, as a matter of fact, and he was a Democrat. In the same party as Stephen Douglas. But it's just fascinating, the history that must be corrected. And I dealt with some of this in my manuscript, in my book, but we'll get into that another time. But it's fascinating. And, of course, James Garfield, who was assassinated today on the 19th of November, he was also a Union general, and he was from Ohio. And Ohio and Virginia are considered the mothers of presidents. More presidents have come from that state than any other. And the last president to come from Ohio, interestingly, was a president who really was the first president who had black or Negro blood, and that was Warren G. Harding, and he was succeeded Woodrow Wilson. And it's in the biographies when Warren Harding was accused of having, quote, Negro blood, he said, "I cannot help it if one of my ancestors jumped over the back fence." And he was the first president to go to the South and tell the Southerners who came to his audiences, and they were segregated audiences, that they had to give the Negro his civil rights. And it was Woodrow Wilson, his predecessor, who was from Virginia. Thomas was his given name, Thomas Woodrow Wilson. He wasn't a lawyer, by the way. He was a university professor, but he must have known some law like a lot of politicians. But he was the one that segregated Washington. It's interesting. And also another man from that time that ties into all this, J. Edgar Hoover, it said that he had some African heritage. But, you know, he built the FBI, and then he stayed around too long, like a lot of these people. Now, today I have finally converted the tape, part of the tape. It's a long, it was about an hour and a half interview with Colonel Trevor Hodges, who was born in England. He's one of the few people who served in the British Army in World War I at Gallipoli, the Battle of the Somme, and in World War II, after World War II, there was a depression in World War I, excuse me, there was a depression in England, and a lot of Englishmen emigrated legally to the States and became Americans. And it's an interesting what he said. And this interview was done 20 years ago, by the way, shortly before he died. It's the only interview he ever did in his 88 years, and I have to thank the Australian government and the consulate here in San Francisco that after I got back from Australia as a correspondent, they said, hey, do you know there's a guy who was at served with the Anzacs and the British at the Gallipoli, and he was living down in San Jose in a retirement home, and I contacted him and went down, and we had a great afternoon, and it's a rare tape, and I would like to give portions of it to historical military historical societies so that people can, this oral history is very important. And last week, of course, we had Brigadier Ingall, the Bengal Lancers, who was the foremost British military and political authority on the subcontinent, and he, of course, he died. He lived here in San Francisco, no, in Marin County, but the consulate was the Pakistani consulate, and he was honorary consul, was here in San Francisco. And it's funny that the sun may have set on the British Empire, but not on the British soldiers who were living, British military and other foreign military who were living in California. But what's important about Trevor Hodges is what he witnessed at one of the worst battles in World War I, and I'm going to play the excerpt from that tape right now.
Trevor, when you were in Trevor, when you were in France on the Somme in World War I, did anything happen with animals that you can recall?
Yes, a very dreadful thing. Whether it was in 16 or early 17, I don't know. But my little unit, smoke unit, was out of the trenches resting. And I was awakened before dawn by a clickety-clank sound. And I looked out of my tent, and there was cavalry going up towards the front line. Well, they got slaughtered. They got through the first lot of barbed wire, which had been pretty well blasted by the artillery. But the artillery hadn't done enough job on the second load, and they got all tangled up, and those beautiful horses were slaughtered right and left. Thank God I didn't actually see it. But all I know is that for 2 months after that, the whole British Army ate horse meat.
I guess that beats bully beef.
I'm not so sure.
When did they stop using horses during World War I, when tanks came in?
The first tank was a failure because they ran the tanks when there were just about 8 or 9 of them. And of course they got right through the German lines, but then were blasted to hell. If they'd only waited until they had 200 or 300 tanks, they could have ended the war right then. Right then.
This was on the Somme?
No, further down the line, Flers, F-L-E-R-S. The infantry walked behind the tanks, but there weren't enough tanks. And the breach wasn't wide enough. If they had a large number of tanks, they could have spread out behind the German lines and
enveloped them.
Yes, that's right.
Any more interesting animal stories that
no,
you...
No, that's the end of the story.
Well, that was an excerpt from an hour and a half interview done with Trevor Hodges, done in San Jose about 20 years ago. And I'm glad the tape survived. It's the only one done. Now, it's interesting. I talked earlier about Gettysburg. Gettysburg, the battlefield of Gettysburg, is to Americans. It's a holy shrine, and just like Verdun is to the French. I've been through Verdun at night, and I've been to battlefields, Little Bighorn, where some of my ancestors may have fought. But I was there at night, and it was kind of funny. I was traveling with some dogs cross country, and dogs got very uneasy when I got to the little bighorn, and I got out, and the dogs didn't want to get out of the vehicle with me. I could swear that I heard the sounds of moaning and the cries of the dying and the wounded. And when I was in Verdun, back in the 70s, about the time of the massacre at Munich, well, I wasn't there, but I was traveling around Europe, and I had to stop at Verdun. I was coming back from Salzburg, as a matter of fact, and holy Salzburg, and I went to see the Berchtesgaden. I didn't realize it. Hitler had a hell of a view in those Austrian mountains, but what a horrible man. Anyway, I got to Verdun at night, and I got out of the car, and I just walked in the battlefield, and again, I thought I heard the sounds of men wounded and dying. I've talked to other people who have had similar experiences, but the Somme is to the British. It's one of these sites that more and more Brits are visiting when they go on holiday on the continent in France. So, and it's said that the Somme is to the British what the Gettysburg battlefield is to Americans. So, and I would encourage everybody, really, those who forget history are bound to repeat it, and that's George Santayana's quotation. And I would add to that, and when we repeat it, it's often worse the second time around, as we have seen. The other thing is, very few people know about the horrible slaughter in World War One. I'm going to just give you some stats. It's interesting. The battle started around July of 1916. They thought they would crush the British. Thought they would crush the generals, and they had a cavalry general, Sir Douglas, Sir John French, and Douglas Haig. And what happened, it cost the British over nearly 58,000 casualties. And this is interesting. This casualty figure was greater than the total combined British casualties in the Crimean, Boer, and the Korean Wars. They don't talk about the Afghan Wars. And in contrast, the French, with fewer divisions, suffered only about 2,000 casualties. Apparently, it may have been the incompetence of the British military, who still thought they were fighting the Zulus and at Omdurman in Ethiopia, and the Afghan wars. And as I brought up on the other shows that we've done, and Brigadier Ingle, it's the fact, and the British should realize this, that it's going to be a disaster for them in Afghanistan, and that they are forgetting their own history, that they had four disastrous wars up there, known as the Afghan Wars during the reign of Victoria, and they lost every damn one of them. And the only thing you can do with that country, in my opinion, as a historian and other people who I've talked to about this situation, is to contain the bastards. You know, containment works. And, you know, we've got to help the Pakistanis keep those Taliban out. And keep in mind that this is another political fiction, that Islam is a peaceful religion. It is not. It has not been. And all you have to do is go back through history. Even in our own history, during the presidency of Thomas Jefferson, we had the Tripolitan Wars, where the North African pirates, who were the Islamists of their day, would terrorize the shipping lanes all around the Mediterranean and that part of the Atlantic. And when they got, they went up as far north, and even the Turks went up, traveled as far north as Lithuania, Estonia, and those countries. And what they would do, they particularly captured the young men, and they, if they weren't circumcised, they would do a half circumcision. This is where we get the term Christian dog. And it's quite interesting. But American seamen were terrorized, and finally a detachment of our fledgling young Navy was sent over there, the Tripolitan Wars, with people like Stephen Decatur and Bainbridge, and put an end to the terrorizing of American shipping. So that's just one of them. And they had the history of the Crusades, when the Christians fought with the Islamists, and when they came up, and remember, for 300 years they were in southern Spain. I would suggest you see the movie El Cid, which is fairly accurate, where they were finally kicked out when Queen Elizabeth married Ferdinand, and they united the provinces of Castile and Aragon. And then, of course, Columbus came out of that. With after that war was won, they kicked the Muslims out, the Islamists out, and he financed or helped finance Columbus's explorations and some people say exploitation of the natives in this part of the world. So there's a lot of history that ties in. And then again, people should remember that the Poles, a Polish general, Jan Sobieski, was a battle in 1500, in the 1500s, where they stopped the Turks at Vienna. And out of that, and you see it today, it's interesting, the crescent on the is on some of those flags. It's a green background and a white crescent. But out of that came the croissant, which in French means crescent. And what it, and the origin of the croissant is that after the battle, this, they won the Christians won the battle, Jan Sobieski and people, and they ordered the bakers to come up with something to commemorate the battle. So they came up with bread shaped in the form of a crescent. And so today we and the French enjoy croissants and dipping them in their coffee. And, of course, now we have chocolate croissants, which are an insult. A true Frenchman wouldn't eat that sort of thing. Those of you who have seen the 48 Hours last Saturday, depiction or the news documentary on the Hugues de la Plaza homicide, there'll be more on that, and we have stuff which we've done independently on our video, and the whole bad. It's a very fascinating background of this case, and you know, my dog and other dogs detected blood on the steps and elsewhere around there, and I did talk to the crime scene people, and they said that it looked like there had been a struggle. So I don't know that San Francisco, the current coroner was a woman. She sounded vaguely competent at best. So, but we'll have stuff on that. Incidentally, we'll be putting up the video on a thing that nobody is talking about, and that is the federal funding of community clinics. Turns out there are nearly 6,000 or more. They're not going to the clinic with that sound. There may be there are over 6,000 or approximately 6,000 of these clinics across the country, and they provide basic care. You won't get a mastectomy or liver transplant or a heart transplant or a foreskin restoral or transgender. The foreskin restoral, that's the gays are pushing that along with sex change or gender change. You won't find these services at these community health clinics, but you will find basic preventive and health maintenance, and it's, and even people who are non-citizens or illegal aliens, excuse me, cannot be denied care. It's in the federal regulations, and I'll bring that up. And we have at least six of these clinics spread across San Francisco. And you know, this is a Nancy Pelosi stomping grounds, although they wish she'd go back to Baltimore. And it's really surprising that she ignores the fact that these services are available, and they serve an estimated 15 to 16 million people. We will repeat part of this program on Saturday, and we may expand that program to a half an hour also. And you may go to our YouTube site. It's the YouTube Amicus Veritas, AMICUS. Veritas, and then our master websites where we have the Steve Neri case, which is not going to go away. It's like Banquo's ghost in Macbeth. Until that sailor gets justice and all the others, there are some others who have been abused by local civil authority, corrupt local civil authority. But anyway, go to our master website, amicusveritas.org, and our blog, and go to the others. Voter fraud, portable housing racket, and we'll be giving you tips on charity and how to protect yourself during the Christmas season and how to make sure that if that letter absolutely has to, positively has to get there, tips on how to expedite your mail when the post office is cutting back services and still increasing postal rates. Last week I talked about in the 1800s we had the penny stamp. And I remember when I was growing up that postage was like 3 or 5 cents. So I want to thank you all for listening, and if you missed anything, tune in Saturday. This is Peter Paul Brazilla and the New Shadow. Thanks for listening.